grace.
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 Didn't realize until we were singing it how accurate and how apropos some of the opening words to that second song that we sang is to the whole book of Songs of Ecclesiastes. Says we only get so many times to ride around the sun and so many times to see a full moon shine. And when day is done, if anything's worth doing, then it's worth doing right. So I looked for wisdom on how to best live this life, which is what he's been talking about. And I found, blessed is he who fears the Lord.
God, I love that.
Finds delight in his commands. And I guess that we all gamble on some truth to guide our days. And we trust that we'll bring joy and meaning along the way. That's literally what the entire book is about. And encapsulated form right there. I never didn't even know that was going to be in the song. It didn't occur to me when I picked it. But man, they couldn't get a better synopsis of the purpose and the direction of the book of Ecclesiastes. So we're in chapter 11. I could have easily pressed through to chapter 12, but I think 12 is so incredibly important that I want to take time with it. It may take less time than I anticipate, but I don't want to rush it. So Ecclesiastes chapter 11 is what we're covering tonight. Now, this first verse in the New English translation is radically different than I have ever heard it. But it's also the first time it actually ever made any sense to me. Traditionally, most of the translations will say, cast your bread upon the water, and after many days it will return to you, which has always seemed like to be the most ludicrous statement I've ever read in my life. Like, who would cast your bread on the water expecting it back? And if you did, who would want it? You know, it makes absolutely no sense. It's soggy, falling apart, it's nasty, and probably would not return in the first place, but be eaten by fish or birds or sink to the bottom. So it makes absolutely no sense read that way. And so I had no idea. I've never thought. I knew it has to mean something, but I'm like, I'm not sure what it is. I know the way the Pentecostal and so on charismatic movement always took it. And they weren't entirely wrong, and yet they were. The idea that I always heard growing up was that if I will give, then it will be given back to me. Good measure, pressed down, running over. That is a truth. It's not the truth of this verse. And I do like the way the English New English translation says it. It says, send your grain overseas, for after many days you will get a return. In other words, it's a verse about commerce. It's to export goods and receive funds back for those goods. That's all it's talking about. And because the word cast is often used in many translations, but send is an equally accurate term. Bread is also often used in place of grain, but both translations of this word are well represented in Scripture. A lot of times this word that's often translated bread here is translated grain in a multitude of other scriptures, same word. And so in the end, I think common sense wins out. You know, if you cast your bread upon the water, it will not return to you after many days. It's just going to fall apart and get eaten by something else. It makes many times more sense to believe that it's talking about exporting grains for profit. And profit seems to be the theme of the first few verses as well, making the translation even more likely. Because you get to verse 2, it says, divide your merchandise. So we're talking about merchandise, right? Among 7 and even 8 investments. For you do not know what calamity may happen on the earth. Now, this is very much akin to mutual funds. I don't know how much you know about investments, but mutual funds will pool money from many investors to buy a wide diversity of stocks, bonds, and other securities. And this diversifies your financial portfolio. So, thereby decreasing your overall risk from having all your eggs in one basket, so to speak, right? And that's really the advice here. That's what he's saying. He says, don't stick all your eggs in one basket and diversify your assets, diversify your, the things that you invest in, because if one goes belly up, you haven't lost everything, right? And in fact, if you're smart, like a lot of people who play the stock market and invest in bonds and other securities and so on, they know that they had that typically speaking, if this commodity goes down, this one's going to go up. And so they diversify and they invest in both. So at one point or another, something's always going to be up while the other one's down. You're not losing anything. If at very worst, it's balancing out. Many times you may show it actually in a profit instead. So they're cautious, and that's really the advice he's giving, because he says you don't really know what's coming. And it's because, and that's a theme we've seen since the very beginning, while we're under the sun, we don't know what we're going to get. Borrowing from Forrest Gump's, life is a box of chocolates. You never know what you're going to get until you bite into it. So that's literally the truth. And so that being the truth, you can approach life with more wisdom by doing certain things. And this is one of the things, by diversifying what you invest in, you wind up leveraging the possibility of loss. Now, verse 3, it says, if the clouds are full of rain, this is all building to one point. Says if the clouds are full of rain, they will empty themselves on the earth. And whether a tree falls to the south or to the north, the tree will lie wherever it falls. Solomon is saying you can't control everything. Whatever happens, happens. It is what it is. Worrying or using the possibility of adversity to avoid taking action is not wise, which is what the next verse affirms. He who watches the wind won't sow, and he who observes the clouds will not reap. If you're always looking at external possibilities, this could cause this, therefore I won't even bother. Well, then you're not going to get anything anyway, right? It's not really what he's saying, but it's not too much different than aim for the moon. And that way, even if you miss, you still are higher off than you were when you started, right? So I think that's the overall idea here. Now, Solomon encourages us not to allow ignorance to lead to unchaste thoughts or despairs and woe. It is true, you do not know what tomorrow is going to bring, but if you do nothing, then your cowardice and overcaution will certainly generate a scenario very similar to the one you were trying to avoid in the first place. So if you do something, you're going to very likely get something good out of it, even if it's a very, very tiny amount. If you do nothing, you're guaranteed to get the very thing you're afraid was going to happen if you did something. So, it only makes sense. Just go ahead and roll the dice. So the worst thing that can happen is get the same thing you would have gotten if you did nothing, which is nothing. You haven't lost anything, right? Just take a step, right? So he encourages us to go ahead and commit to something. Do whatever you do with all of your might. If you plant seed, then plant several varieties, because you don't know what will prosper and what will not. But not planting anything will certainly end in poverty and hunger. So that's the overall scope of what he's trying to say there. Verse 5, but it also, again, it speaks to and builds on the overall point of everything in this book, which is while we are living under the sun, you have no idea what the outcomes are going to be. You can be a righteous person and bad stuff happen to you. You can be an evil person and have nothing but prosperity all of your natural life under the sun. But there's more to the story, because under the sun is not your entire existence. It's just a little tiny sliver of the eternity that you'll be spending. So he deals with ignorance and the fleeting nature of what occurs during this life through the whole book. And so he's really kind of bringing some of this to a head in these exact same same statements here. Verse 5 and 6 says, just as you do not know the path of the wind or how the bones form in the womb of a pregnant woman, so you do not know the work of God who makes everything. Sow your seed in the morning and do not stop working until evening, for you do not know which activity will succeed, whether this one or that, or whether both will prosper equally. Now, these are very practical statements regarding life and provision, which address motive and motivation, which becomes very, very important as we make the transition from chapter 11 to chapter 12. And you'll see why, because the word motivation is brought up later on. But it's very practical statements regarding the life and provision, which address motive and motivation, incentive, apathy, encouraging action with caution. Do take action, but don't do it stupidly, right? Be cautious and be wise in the way that you take action. Verse 7 and 8. Light is sweet, and it is pleasant for a person to see the sun. So if a man lives many years, let him rejoice in them all, but let him remember that the days of darkness will be many. All that is about to come is obscure. There he goes further with that idea, right? You don't know what's coming. Light is sweet. It's pleasant for a person to see the sun, to have sunshiny days, blue skies, and birds chirping and all that. So if a man lives many years, let him rejoice in all those kind of days, because you're not going to have a lot of them, because of the fact that there's going to be days of darkness, and they will be many. And all that's about to come is obscure. You don't know what's coming the next day. I mean, Florida is a great place to live to know that, because if you don't like the weather, just wait. It's going to change, right? I have to try to plan some of my work because it's outside based on what the meteorologist says, but I also know Florida. I've been here, unfortunately, my whole life. And knowing Florida, I know how to read the season a little bit. I can read the day pretty well. I can go out there in the morning, and if it's a hot, sunny, clear day, there's a sense of the fact that I'm probably going to have showers before 2 o'clock. You just know, because you've been living it long enough. You just have a sense. It's not just, we're not just talking about from habitual patterns, but you just know. I have times when the meteorologist will say there's a 60% chance of rain after 2 o'clock. I'm like, in other words, you mean it's not going to rain at all? Okay, thank you. Because I already know that. I know it going in. You just have a sense. You just know. And these kind of intuitions are a good thing to have. But the truth of the matter is, you don't know with absolute certainty. Both I and the meteorologist could be dead wrong, and it could snow. You just don't know what's going to happen. So just buckle yourself in, plan as best you can. I remember, when I first got married, it was a bit of epiphany to me to realize that women dress in layers, because I don't. To me, it's always hot. So dressing without any more extra clothing than necessary is always appropriate. But, you know, Terry, she would wear this and this, and she'd bring this and this. So as an onion, she could layer herself or unlayer herself accordingly. Because I'm like, we're about to go, say, to the outlet mall. It's Florida. You don't need a jacket. I'm telling you, it's 90 degrees outside. But when she walks through the store, the door of the store, within 2 or 3 minutes, she's cold. Within 2 or 3 minutes, I'm still got steam rising off my body. I will never get cold in that store. So it doesn't occur to me, layers. Are you getting what I'm saying? But she plans. And that's kind of the one thing that Solomon is getting at, that you don't know what's going to happen. And so just plan. Bring the rain jacket anyway, right? And that way, worst case scenario, you got a little bit extra muscle because you're carried more than you had to bring, but you didn't get out there needing something you didn't bring, right? So, and that's kind of the idea of what he's getting at in a lot of this. Now Solomon begins to shift his tone and attention. Chapter 11, verse 9 is quite literally the pivot point of the entire book. Now you think of pivot points, you're usually in the dead center. Not so here. This is literally where the entire thing takes a paradigm shift. You could literally start chapter 12 right now, okay? Because this is the pivot point of the entire book. Up until now, Solomon has presented us a book filled with subjective views of what benefits mankind and what doesn't. What externally seems fair while we live out our physical lives and what does not. What collectively is foolish, fleeting, and without value as compared with what possesses real and lasting value. What Solomon now encourages is a glance behind the curtain, if you will, a consideration of what is to come beyond what's under the sun, where we will have to own in one final and eternal reality the consequences of the choices we make while we're under the sun. So he's been inviting us to expand the considerations, right? He started out at the beginning of the book saying that, you know what? I set my course to study and examine all that is worthwhile and what is vain and what is fleeting and temporal and what has lasting value under the sun, to show men what would be valuable for them to invest their time in. And up to this point, the only thing he's really said two or three times is, work, and I'm going to bring this up in a minute again, but work with whatever delights your hand. And then from the proceeds of your labor, eat and drink and enjoy, because this is the gift of God, and pretty much everything else stinks. That's pretty much it. And then you're going to die. I mean, that's the whole thing so far, right? And how unfair this seems. Now he's saying, I want you now that you're in Oz, look behind the curtain, see who's been talking to you, right? Now that you're here, now let's look at the consequences of these decisions and understand there's more to the story than we've mentioned up to this point, all right? So that's really where we are in verse 9. So, and this is where God's intentions in inspiring this book and Solomon's personal reasons for writing it begin to meet up with one another, okay? Because they are different. They were radically different. These closing verses will also serve as our beginning, as an intro kind of to our verses that we're going to begin with next week as we work through the final chapter. There are distinct advantages to placing these last two verses at the very end of this chapter and starting fresh with a new thought in chapter 12, because that benediction lets you leave with a thought that is complete and leaves you thinking about it before you go on to chapter 12 and realize that chapter 12 is really just a continuation of the thought. It's a good thing to sit and ponder what he ends with this chapter before going on to the next. So there's advantages to just reading straight through. There's also a great advantage to pausing here and not going forward. So let's go ahead and look at verse 9. Rejoice, young man, while you are young, and let your heart cheer you in the days of your youth. Follow the impulses of your heart. This all sounds like terrible advice, by the way. You know, follow the impulses of your heart. When's the last time a good, responsible parent tells a child, run after the impulses of your heart? That's a good way to get them killed, right? But he's saying here, follow after the impulses of your heart and the desires of your eyes, but know that God will judge your motives and your actions. Oh, wait a minute. Now we're putting the brakes on. This is the first statement of balanced enjoyment with caution in the entire book. First one. Solomon has often concluded that it was best, that the best there is for mankind while under the sun is to busy ourselves with work which is best suited to our skills and which brings the greatest satisfaction and delight, than to take the proceeds of that labor and eat and drink so as to enjoy the short times of joy afforded you in this life. And he presents this as God's gift to us. Here Solomon continues with this same encouragement, especially when you're young and have the strength and vigor to make the most of it, but he cautions us to do whatever we do with a view to the fact that our actions are before the eyes of God, whom we will have to offer an account to. Interestingly, Solomon draws the height of his attention not to our actions alone, but rather to the motives behind them. That's why I told you to pay attention to the word motive earlier, right? God sees all and will try all. This is the introduction to the book's conclusion, which drives our attention towards motives and actions which will best hold up under the scrutinizing gaze of our Creator. So he's introducing us now to the Creator. He's kind of mentioned it time and time throughout the book, but it's usually in things that he views as being kind of unfair, right? God comes in and judges things, and sometimes he judges it so it looks like the evil guy gets off the hook and the good guy lowers the boom on him. And a lot of this just doesn't seem fair, you know? And so he brings up the Creator periodically throughout the narrative up to this point, but usually it's in expressions of things that, you know what, I'm not really sure where God's head is in all of this, because it doesn't seem to add up from my perspective. From a guy who lives his entire life under the sun, this makes no sense. it seems unfair. Now he's introducing our accountability before God as a sobering reality. But if we esteem, if we limit our enjoyment to things which God allows, sanctions, and smiles upon, and we do them in joyful respect to the giver of these gifts, then there's a reward for that. The eat and drink and enjoy, it is the gift of God. If you eat it and consume it and enjoy it as that, God's gift to me, I'm not only honoring the one who gave the gift, but I'm respecting him, even in my enjoyment, right? But if we esteem these gifts higher than the Creator, replace the giver with the gifts he gives, then we make ourselves idolaters, and the substitution is both serious and deadly. And the great majority of this planet lives in that condition, including maybe even especially those who live in the four walls of the church. Now, if you'll permit me, I'm going to quote one of my favorite books, The Pursuit of God by A.W. Tozer. It's from the beginning of the second chapter, which is entitled The Blessedness of Possessing Nothing. It says, before the Lord God made man upon the earth, he first prepared for him a world of useful and pleasant things for his sustenance and delight. In the Genesis account of the creation, these are simply called things. They were made for man's use, but they were meant always to be external to the man and subservient to him. In the deep heart of the man was a shrine where none but God was worthy to come. Within him was God. Without, a thousand gifts which God has showered upon him. But sin has introduced complications and has made those very gifts of God a potential source of ruin for the soul. Our woes began when God was forced out of his central shrine and things were allowed to enter. Within the human heart, things have taken over. Men have now by nature no peace within their hearts, for God is crowned there no longer. But there in the moral dusk, stubborn and aggressive usurpers fight among themselves for first place on that throne. This is not a mere metaphor, but an accurate analysis of our real spiritual trouble, the tyranny of things. Our Lord referred to this tyranny of things when he said to his disciples, if any man will come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. For whoever will save his life will lose it, but whoever shall lose his life for my sake shall find it. Breaking this truth into fragments for our better understanding, it would seem that there is within each of us an enemy which we tolerate at our own peril. Jesus called it life and self, or as we would say, the self-life. Its chief characteristic is its possessiveness. The word gain and profit in Jesus' words suggests this. To allow this enemy to live is in the end to lose everything. To repudiate it and give up all for Christ's sake is to lose nothing at last, but to preserve everything unto eternal life. And possibly also a hint is given here as to the only effective way to destroy this foe, and that is by the cross. Let him take up his cross and follow me. So that's the quote, and I could think of no better quote to fit what we just read. So Solomon called upon us to banish all but God from that inner shrine in our hearts. So move on now to verse 10. Banish emotional stress from your mind and put away pain from your body, for youth and the prime of life are fleeting. Now on the surface, this reading is a little troublesome. Because what young person would deliberately inflict pain upon their body? Because he says, banish emotional stress from your mind and put away pain from your body. Why would you have to tell someone to do that? Most people are not running towards pain, they're running away from it, right? So it seems like a little bit of a troublesome thing to say. Why would he say that? The words translated as pain here almost certainly does not mean don't harm your body in a literal self-injurious sense. The opening of the verse helps to provide the context for understanding the entire verse, and it encourages young people to remove emotions which tend towards stress. So that's what he starts off with. So that being the thing he begins with, we need to view our understanding of pain in the flesh through the lens of stress in the emotions, okay? Because that's what he starts with. Now, what kind of stress is he referring to? Well, these include, but are not limited to, things such as anger, jealousy, bitterness, anxiety, despair, loneliness, self-consciousness, and shame, just simply to name a few. And these emotional extremes are pervasive in teens and young adults, since their entire world is in flux at such an age, which you notice that's who he's talking to, youth, right? Their bodies are continually in change. Their hormones fluctuate widely. Life has not yet taken a long-term final shape. So everything, all the balls are still in the air, nothing settled. They're often stressed between knowing what they want to pursue in life against what they feel like they're good enough to pursue. And added to this is the pressing concern of failure and what they believe other people think about them. It is all in all a very, very stressful time of life, you know, which is great advice. Banish stress from your heart, right? Because youth is fleeting. What's part of the thing he's implying there is a lot of the stuff that's really troubling you in your youth, 20 years from now, you really won't give much thought to. You're letting you're giving way too much priority to things of fleeting value. Remove stress. It's not worth it, right? So Solomon encourages them not to indulge in these emotions and thought patterns through engaging with them. I mean, they're going to present themselves, but then you just walk right by them. Don't engage with them, right? You see what I'm saying? There's an opportunity to worry here and wonder and get concerned myself with what do my friends think? What do my my parents think? What does my professor think? What does my employer think? Or you could say, you know what? Who cares? I need to do the best I can do at what I believe is right and then let the cards fall where they may. They're not my final judge, right? Don't stress. So Solomon encourages us not to indulge in these emotions through patterns, thought patterns through engaging with them. So the context is one which requires or regards, I should say, the destructive effects of one's hearts from overthinking and over-evaluating everything. Stop that. Just stop it. So when he shifts his attention to the body, it seems more consistent with the flow of thought here that this call is to remove harmful tendencies from their life, since the word flesh here can mean also extend to the whole person or your entire physical existence. The word flesh can extend to that meaning. Okay? So remove harm or harmful tendencies from your entire existence. As such, this could include the type of wayward living that the young are particularly prone to, staying up too late, indulgent consumption of food or alcohol, smoking and the use of drugs, overexertion, along with other forms of excessive behavior, including too much study or overworking or not getting enough rest. All of these things are things that young people and young adults going into college have a tendency to engage themselves in. And all of these have a destructive and harmful effect on the body, and if continued in, can become the adopted norm leading into your long-term adulthood. This is a pattern I established in. I just never got out of it. 20 years later, you're still this compulsive, driven person, and it is having a destructive wearing away effect on your life. All of these have that same quality of destruction and harmful effect. As such, a possible paraphrase of this verse would be, take anger out of your heart and keep harmful ways away from your whole life because youth passes quickly. In many ways, this seems to capture the moral and practical force of the verse better than a literal idea of bodily injury does. And now, it's no stretch of the imagination to consider that most young adults live as if they believe they are superhuman. When, you know, when their heart gets broken over puppy love, they rebound relatively quickly and strong. When they fall, they don't typically break. When they overindulge, they tend to snap back pretty quickly. And this tends towards a mindset of indestructibility, but it's not going to last. Every adult in the world said, in the entire world said amen to that, right? I know all too well that in these, that environment of mental and emotional invulnerability, I guess you feel superhuman. Now, you don't think that. You're not thinking, I feel superhuman. But when you're an adult and you look back on it, you think, dang, I must have thought I was superhuman, right? Because they don't think anything's going to hurt them. It's easy to acquire habits during in that environment, which will bring great harm later on in your life. Emotionally, I'm going to use myself in a few examples. Emotionally, I was pretty resilient as a young person. I didn't take much to heart if someone picked on me or put me down. In fact, I saw it as a challenge and would just deal it back. It was fun to me. I didn't see it as an attack against my character. It typically was just water off the duck's back to me. You know, and I dealt it out with regular proficiency as well. And I wound up wounding and hurting people that I dearly loved. Because it never even occurred to me that that kind of banter could actually hurt someone. Who would take that seriously? I mean, I never did. So I couldn't imagine, I couldn't conceptualize a person walking away wounded by my words. Their words didn't wound me. I just laughed it off. But my words were wounding other people. Not everybody, but some people were just responding the same way I would. But you ran the risk of hurting people and burning bridges with people who were precious in your life. Right? So this nothing ever hurts me, everything works right mentality of your youth doesn't always pan out. Sometimes it has long time consequences. Physically, in my youth, I fell off roofs, ladders, slammed car doors completely shut on my fingers, bounced my head off of sidewalks, and always walked away with little more than a bump and a bruise. I mean, I never got hurt. I just never really got hurt. So when I got married, I thought nothing of, you know, Terry will remember this, leaning a 30-plus foot extension ladder against a three-story house where the bottom of the ladder was precariously balanced on the top of a workhorse on the bottom of an empty pool at an incline just so I could reach a fascia and paint it by myself without anybody else there. Never even occurred to me because Mark never gets hurt. Now, I'm not thinking in my mind, I'm Superman. If I fell, I would get hurt. I wouldn't get hurt. I wasn't thinking that. I just was testing everything on the way up the top of the ladder. I'm like, sure, I can do this, and just kept on doing it. Never thought a thing about it. Now, I would never do that. I wouldn't do that on a 5-foot ladder. But, you know, I just had insanity kind of, you know, bred into me when it came to doing things like that. But it worked. I mean, most of the time it worked. I didn't get hurt, and it only added to my superhuman view of life. Another time, however, on a much shorter ladder, an A-frame ladder, I balanced myself on 1 foot while holding a plastic sheet up on the ceiling with this hand, and this foot. And, while a guy was spraying, popcorn ceiling, acoustic ceiling on the ceiling of an apartment we were working on. I saw nothing wrong with that because if you ever use a hopper and you spray that, it creates a vacuum and it would suck that plastic up in it. So you have to pin it to everything so that doesn't happen. Well, I have two hands and I've got an extra appendage here. I'll just put my foot over there and just balance on the bat, on the ladder. Well, of course, this is one time it didn't work. I fell. My ladders got twisted inside the ladder and I fell down on top of a very hard tile floor. And I got up and my knee hurt excruciatingly. But even still, that wasn't enough to teach me a thing because I thought, because I never get hurt. I'm not lying to you. The first thought in my mind was, oh, it'll go away. I'll feel better in a few minutes. I mean, it was excruciating pain, but I thought, well, it'll go away. It always goes away. And so I just got up and I walked on it for another 4 hours. And before my wife came to pick me up, because that was the time when we only had one car and I was working for another guy, she came to pick me up. My knee had swelled up to the size of a cantaloupe and I could put zero pressure on it whatsoever without feeling I was going to pass out. Even still, the elevator had not reached the top because when I get into the van, through a huge amount of effort, I kind of chuckled it off because I just knew, you know, it'll be better by tomorrow. I'm going to wake up and my knees could be perfectly fine. I couldn't have been any more wrong. I mean, it was damaged very badly. Should have probably gone to the hospital, but no, I never did that either. So I just waited until it got better, which was weeks. But, you know, my point is that my knee got really hurt because I was living under patterns I'd established in my youth when I was indestructible, when nothing ever hurts me. You know what I'm saying? And these things can manifest both in emotional areas and in mental areas and in physical areas. And it's a bad thing. I did the exact same thing with my rotator cuffs, and I damaged both of them at the exact same time, so that for weeks I couldn't use my arms at all, period. I mean, I couldn't even brush my teeth. I could do nothing because I couldn't lift it up. I mean, this is as high as I'd get either one of my arms. That was it. And it's because I was walking on top of pallets stacked 15 to 20 feet high in where I was working, carrying 50-pound bags on both shoulders and jumping from pallet to pallet to get down where I needed to be. And one time I fell between the pallets, whipped both my arms above my head and tore both rotator cuffs. And even then I thought, oh, it'll be fine. Because it had always been fine. So, you know, you get the idea. I mean, a little tiny bit of humor, but you get the idea that these kind of things cause problems. So in your youth, avoid all this. Think ahead, plan, which goes up with the earlier things we read earlier. You know, don't put all your eggs in one basket. Plan, you know, make sure that you're looking at all angles before you, you know, look before you leap, all of that. So I can say that this is a wise word of caution from Solomon, not only in the more obvious and practical areas of life, like I just mentioned, but in the more subtle ones as well. He rightly observes that youth is fleeting. It doesn't last. No one tells you when you're going to turn that magical corner. It's like flicking a switch. And, you know, you can go from being made of indestructible rubber to being made of porcelain overnight. And the transition is made none the easier due to this bloated superhuman mindset that you adopted when you were younger. So without overnaturalizing Solomon's warning, the verse is part of Ecclesiastes' greater advice to enjoy youth responsibly while remembering that your youth is not going to last that long. So do not let youthful passion turn into anger or bitterness or reckless behavior or the kind of trouble that poisons your whole mind and life. Because more often than not, once the pattern is set, addictive behavior becomes the norm, and the harm is both cumulative and irreparable. So that's what he ends with. Real nice, pretty thought. Going into chapter 12, which actually really boosts you up into the stratosphere with where he's headed with this, okay? Which is really very good stuff. But it was good to ground us in some common sense first. Are you hearing what I'm saying? So if you, we're not going to, but if you were to turn the page, you'd say it's the word, the first word is so. So he's building, isn't he? So remember now your creator in the days of youth. Keep your mind on him. Enjoy yourself. Nothing about this was giving the lie to, I want you to enjoy yourself in your youth. I want you to run after the delight of your heart, but make sure it's tempered with wisdom, and don't do things that would be an offense to your creator, and do those things as an enjoyment of a gift from him rather than a replacement for him. Right? Remember your creator in the days of your youth. So we got a really, really good lesson coming next week. That is a conclusion of, as even Solomon himself says, it's the conclusion of the whole matter. And it's a good one. So, and it keeps you in good stead. It very much agrees, I believe, with the statement that Matt is made in Micah. And I'll probably quote that next week as well. So, does anybody have any questions or thoughts about chapter 11 or how it's kind of bringing to a head everything we've read in the book so far?
Is there a contrast? Is he contrasting here when he said in verse 8, let him remember that the days of darkness will be many?
Mm-hmm.
And that could be like when you're getting older and then he's comparing it to the youthfulness.
There is a connection there. The one is the chapter, verse 8 is still talking to the general populace,
right,
which includes both young people and middle-aged and the elderly. And he's saying, you know, yeah, I want you to enjoy these things as best you can while the good days are there, because I'm telling you, the bad days are going to outnumber them. Okay? So Don't, part of the advice is don't let the bad days overshadow the good days so you don't enjoy them when they're there, right? Because, you know, that's a tendency of negative people, is because yesterday was bad, even though today is all coming up roses, I won't allow myself to enjoy it because I know a bad day is probably coming the next day, and I'd rather not build up my hope just to have it dashed to the stones. So I'll just stay right here emotionally. And Solomon's saying, that's just stupid. You're protecting your heart. Don't protect your heart. Enjoy the day while it's there. Are you hearing? Don't cast it aside. Don't approach life with caution. I mean, approach life with caution as far as, you know, don't do stupid things. But when joy is there, get the most out of it. Amen? Because you're not going to have a lot of those days. Get as much as you can. Suck as much life out of that bad boy as you can. Right? Because, yeah, tomorrow might be bad, which is not an excuse to temper today and not enjoy it. It's a reason to enjoy it all the more, right? And then he goes, then right after that, you're right, in many respects, he pits that against or graduates it into, let me focus in on you young people, because most of us adults got this really bad pattern when we were your age and we carried it on to adulthood. Let me give you some advice that will put you in good stead. And so he kind of goes into verse 9 and 10 from that perspective. So yeah, I think that they are pitted against one another in a way, but really more of a, this is the way life is for everybody, but you young people have experienced so little about life, and so much of it for many young people is filled with more fun than not. Just know, enjoy yourself. I want you to enjoy yourself. It's a gift God gives you. But bad days are coming. And youth isn't going to last forever, so make sure what you enjoy yourself doing is stuff that's building towards a stable, not a stable economic future, though that's not bad advice, but on a stable footing with your Creator. Make sure the things that you're enjoying now are not setting destructive, harmful behaviors in your life that are going to come back and tell on you, because right now you're not paying, it seems like your life is toll-free, but I'm telling you, it's building up, and it's not going to stay toll-free for long. So, make wise decisions, right? So does that answer your question? Did you look like you had a follow-up thought? That's fine if you do. That's fine.
These scenarios that we see now with these young people, I guess, communicating by whatever means, and they get together, and next thing you know, they're trying to take over whatever that area happens to be. Mm-hmm. You know, whether it's the streets or the stores or whatever. Mm-hmm. And they find, quote unquote, pleasure in that.
Oh, yeah.
Which is, you know.
But it's destructive behavior. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Ways. But,
yes.
Is that being something that's attributed to a lot of social media or just easy no. access to?
I mean, yeah, social media adds to it to some degree, but it does as much to detract from it as it does to build on it. As much social media out there showing the negative consequences of that kind of behavior as there is encouragement to do it. So it really depends on what they're going to pay attention to. You know, you see both on social media all the time. You know, these kids did this and this kid died because of it. You know, these kids did this and they wound up in jail because of it. But most kids are not going to pay attention to that post. They're going to pay attention to the fun part. So Solomon's telling them, pay attention to the yin and the yang. And then make some good decisions out of the middle of that. So,
for example, comes to mind, the street, what is it? Street racing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, yeah. It seems innocent enough. Yeah. I mean, it's just some harmless fun. No one's going to get hurt. But you don't know that no one's going to get hurt, you know? And beyond that, depending on where you are, if you're in the county as opposed to out of the county, it's also illegal. So, yeah, absolutely. So, and of course, usually it doesn't end there. It usually starts with having one or two beers beforehand. So mixing the two makes it all the more stupid, you know, and it's that kind of thing that Solomon, in some respects, is kind of aiming at. You know, God wants you to enjoy yourself, but he'd like you to live through it, you know, you know, he'd like you to be smart enough to not do something permanently stupid.
Go to these races and preach that right there.
Yeah. So, yeah. But the truth of the matter is the older we get, our stupidity just shifts different forms. You know, we still do pretty dumb stuff, you know. We can't just blame it all on youth, but youth, we're just more filled with stupidity and less caution than we are in our older age, but still.
Youth makes you're more durable than you.
Yeah, you are. You know, no doubt.
You fall off a roof and you pick yourself and you're okay.
Mm-hmm.
you fall off the step when you're old and you're out for a couple
of years. Right. Yeah. That's absolutely the truth. Yeah, I did that a couple of years ago when I was putting up boards for the hurricanes. And I thought I was on the last rung of the ladder and I was stepping back to hit up the ground. And I was actually two rungs up. So it still was only like a foot and a half. Instead of it being 6 inches, it was like a foot and a half. But that little bit was enough to make my knee bend the wrong direction, backwards, and pop my knee out of joint. And oh, Lord. But so, yeah, I was real close to having another knee problem because of that. And it was the same knee that I threw out years ago that if I hadn't been dumb, that probably wouldn't have even been a problem, but it's weak. So, yeah, just little things. But falling off a roof in my youth probably wouldn't have bothered me at all. But, you know, a foot and a half could be deadly now. So, yeah, no doubt about it. Yes. Well, and you know, I'm grateful that also that the Lord gave me some common sense when I got married. I mean, it was something I eased into. I didn't get all at once, but I got realized after I began to get hurt and the hurt stuck, you know, it didn't just go away. I realized, you know what, if I keep doing this, she will have no provider at all because I'll be bedridden. She'll be taking care of me for the rest of my life. So I really began to take my work very seriously and was just overly cautious because I don't want to do something stupid and her pay for the price of it for the rest of her life. So I began to become very, very, very careful. But before I wasn't trying to be, you know, that way. I had never really been hurt. So, I mean, that lasted. So I didn't think anything of it. I wasn't trying to be prideful. I was just dumb, you know? So, but not, thank God, not permanently dumb. I was able to learn something and not stay that way. So, all right. Well, let's go ahead and close in prayer.
Grace. Grace.
Grace.
Grace.